Hello, and welcome to another episode of Balanced Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to reintroduce to you today. Dr. Angela Stanton is a returning guest on our show. Be sure to check out her first appearance on episode 70 of Balanced Body Radio, which is one of our most fascinating and talked about episodes of all time. Dr. Angela Stanton is a neuroeconomist who evaluates changes in human behavior, including chronic pain, decision-making, and hormonal variations in the brain. Her current research is focused on migraine cause, prevention, and treatment without the use of medicines, and her discovery was helped by experimenting on herself. As a long-term sufferer of migraines, Dr. Stanton has dedicated her life to finding their root cause and developed the Stanton Migraine Protocol. She has written many books, including Fighting the Migraine Epidemic, Complete Guide, How to Treat and Prevent Migraines Without Medicines. She currently lives in Southern California. Dr. Angela Stanton, what an honor it is to welcome you back to Balanced Body Radio.
Thank you for inviting me back. It's really great. I can't believe I was one of your first ones. I'm in 70-something for my
That's right.
And now I am way, like, you're into 200-something right now.
We are for sure. Yeah, you're one of our favorites. I reached out to you almost immediately after hearing you appear on the Carnivore Cast podcast with my friend Scott Mazinski. And I just thought that conversation was so absolutely fascinating. Bethany was able to join us last time. This time she's busy working, so it'll be just you and me this time. But I am so excited to have you back on, because again, this is such an interesting topic that we get so many questions about. It's nice to have our first interview where we hosted you and we were able to ask you some of the questions that some of the people ask us about it. And I was thinking maybe we could bring you back on to create like this kind of like a complete beginner's guide to migraine and help people understand what they are, how they can recognize them, and how they can deal with them.
Yeah, that's a very good idea, because so many migraineurs are misdiagnosed. And also many people are told that they have migraines when they don't actually have migraines. So the first step would be, I think, is to understand how can you diagnose a migraine? And it's not easy, because there's no diagnostic tools. There's simply no diagnosis. It's not like you can go and have a finger broken and you can, you know, x-ray or do any kind of scanning and can say, yes, indeed, it's broken and here's a medication, or having cancer or some other serious complications. This is a very serious condition, but there's no diagnosis for it. They have sort of kind of very vague diagnostic tools, like, okay, so the headache itself has to be minimum 4 hours, but then there are other headache types that can last for 4 hours. Then about, there's a total confusion about the kind of headache. Like some of the International Headache Society and some other organizations that sort of kind of define what migraine is. One of them says it has to be a throbbing headache. The other one says it cannot be a throbbing headache. One said it can be all over your head. The other one says, no, it can't. It has to be very specific to one side. The other one says it will have to start behind your eyes. And so all over the place. So it is extremely difficult to diagnose. And most of the diagnosis goes by eliminating all others. So they've eliminated stroke, eliminated seizures, eliminated any other health conditions. And if you're basically completely healthy and you have no other diseases, then you have migraines. If you have also pain or aura, because pain is not even necessary for a migraine. And so it's extremely difficult to diagnose. And so when you have some symptoms and you go to the doctor and they run you through a host of tests and they experiment with a lot of medications, it's simply because it's not defined of what a migraine is. And so my goal with my scientific background was to understand, can I find the cause? And if I can I then go ahead and diagnose a person with migraine? So that's basically, and I'm not a medical doctor, I have to say this up front, so I don't diagnose per se, but at least I personally have a criteria that I apply to people who come to me to tell them whether they do or do not have migraines.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's a really important distinction. You've already mentioned this, and I think before I found your work, I would have said this, and I assume that other people would think this as well if they don't deal with it themselves, that migraine is a bad headache, period. It's just a bad headache. And so as we're discussing like what a migraine is, we could also discuss what a migraine is not, because you're right. Like there is so much confusion out there. And if there's no way to have us, you know, before you came along, have a solid way to diagnose this, it would be, you're right, like terribly difficult to be able to tell somebody whether they have migraines or not.
It's actually quite impossible, because if you don't have, so for example, I found the video, excuse me, the video is a news reporter and she had a migraine in the middle of a newscast and it became very famous. It's about 10, 12 years old. And she didn't appear to, I mean, I don't know if she had a pain or she didn't, we don't know that, but she was in the middle of a sentence reporting on TV live, making a report and said words that were absolutely incomprehensible. And she didn't know it. That was the most interesting part of it, that she had some difficulty uttering some words and she said some words backwards. She said some words that I don't even know what they were saying. There was no way to guess what she was trying to say. And so then they pulled her off the air and they took her to the emergency thinking she had a stroke. And all she had was a migraine. You know, we don't know if she had a headache or not, but this is a migraine. It's very different from anything else. Now, this is just one form of one kind of symptoms. So the symptoms of migraines will depend upon what part of the brain, the particular condition, which is what actually is the cause, affects the migraine. So it affects the brain. So in the brain, we have basically two completely separate hemispheres and they work really differently. Like for example, my speech, my ability to speak is controlled by a center called the Broca area, which is in the left side of the brain. And so if I can't speak, for example, like that news reporter couldn't speak, that's because this area is affected by this particular thing, which is the cause. And it's just on one side, and therefore it usually affects one side. And so that she couldn't speak was very specific because it affected her, not her mouth, but her ability to speak. But it can, for example, affect one area of your brain on the back where your visual area is, then you're going to get an aura, but the aura is going to be in the opposite eye of what area it is touching. Wow. Or affecting. And so all the symptoms, like for example, hemiplegic migraines, their half a body may go offline completely or partially. Like I had a couple of hemiplegic sessions, not a lot. So there's also, there's a whole lot of discussions about, well, I am a hemiplegic migrainer. I am an aura migrainer, but that's not true. Just today, one of our longer time migraineurs said, I've never had an aura in my life. I had all kinds of other migraine symptoms. And 1 year into the protocol, I now have an aura. How is that possible? And it's because it's a different area of the brain. And so we have so many different symptoms that if you're just looking at the symptoms, you can't tell whether you have migraine or not. But note that I haven't even mentioned pain so far.
Right. So how does that play into things?
I'm sorry?
So how does that play into things, the pain itself?
Okay, so the pain itself is for those cases when the brain, okay, so I have to backtrack for this, because so the brain faces itself, or finds itself in a particular situation, and which is the cause. And just to state right up bluntly what it is, it's an electrolyte imbalance in the brain. So if you're looking at a brain cell, which is a neuron, it's not like a round cell like most other cells as we imagine, but it's a long cell and it's covered with layers of myelin, which are layers of cholesterol and fat. So our brain is mostly fat and cholesterol. So it's very important to have the right kind of fat and right kind of cholesterol to eat that. But it's in layers. It looks like little sausages. Like, you know how you get the breakfast sausages and they're connected? But so it's a sausage and another line, a sausage and another line. And so imagine this all through the particular longer part of the cell. And so where there is no cover, no myelin, there are areas that are called nodes of Remy. So these are empty. They're completely open to the environment. And on this spot, you're going to have thousands of little pores. And these little pores are going to be voltage-gated channels and other kinds of channels as well. But voltage-gated channels are the ones that operate the electricity in the neurons. And so on one of these nodes of NBA, I'm just going to say a number. Say you have 100 voltage-gated sodium channels. And so its job is to have all these channels open, sodium rushes into the cell, and that starts the electricity. This is called basically an action potential. And then as it started in that one spot, the rest of the cell knows nothing about this electricity starting at this spot. So then the electricity cell kind of have to travel to the next opening, where you again have, say, 100 voltage-gated sodium channels, where the sodium rushes in, and it sort of kind of picks up that electricity that was created in the first node of NBA's first spot, and picks it up and carries it to the next one, and then goes on and on and on. So the electricity sort of kind of moves through what is called the spike train in the brain. Now, if a neuron, for whatever reason, and we should talk about what the reason is, runs out of sodium in one of these spots, I don't know how many sodium channels would have to go down for it to not function, but an action potential is an all or nothing. So you either have one or you don't have one. There are failed action potentials where it may start and then stop because it didn't reach the threshold at which it can generate an electric power. And if you don't have enough to generate the electricity, then the electricity coming down from the other parts of the neuron all the way through reaches this one spot where there is not enough sodium to pick it up. The cell stops having the voltage. And so it then can't communicate because the cells communicate by the voltage, then it's kicking out the neuropeptides, the little packets of neurotransmitters that then the next cell can pick up and it receives the message. So this is the function of our brain cells. And if for whatever reason this function stops, then that's trouble. And if the brain has a process by which it can fix this. So there is what's called a cortical spreading depression, which is very complicated. I don't want to get deeply into it, but what it is similar to like when you have a heart attack person and the paramedics come and put the machine on to start the voltage. So in the brain is a similar system, but it's built in within the brain and it will create its own voltage current. It will send an electrical current all through the brain, which is called a cortical spreading depression. And it's visible if you're watching it with the proper equipment, a functional magnetic resonance imaging or other kind of scanning, you actually can see. And there are some videos on YouTube on this, the cortical spreading depression. And so it depolarizes the entire brain. And it goes by about 2.5 to 5 millimeters per minute. So it's a slow process. It's not like the electricity in your power cord and you plug it into the outlet. It's very slow because it's organically created electricity rather than just the electrons hopping and going. And so it has to be recreated everywhere. But what it does, it sends basically a current all the way through the brain. It's a large current to sort of activate, like wake up, sort of kind of shake it, wake up. And if it was successful in activating it such that suddenly, in our blood, we have sodium, potassium, glucose, everything else continuously moving. And so every heartbeat, our blood quality, osmolality of these electrolytes changes. And so if this sudden electrical current was able to reset the brain such that suddenly sodium appears where there wasn't before, so the electricity can be started, then all you're going to have is this spreading depression, which can manifest as an aura for some people in some conditions. It is visible as an aura, but it happens in everyone's who has migraine, in every migraine brain, whether you see the aura or not. And by now we know that most people see some form of visual disturbance. It may not be the professional official aura, which looks really like, the lights in the aura borealis, or it could be just ragged lines. But it could be dust, it could be fireworks, it could be just a flashlight equivalent flashing, whatever it is, it's just a disturbance. And so the brain can fix itself. So in this case, you may have a lot of symptoms, but you may not have the pain, because the pain part is when the brain is unable to fix this electrolyte imbalance. And so that's when things break down, because at that point, it's like an emergency signal that's going on. And that initiates a cascade, which I call the tri-migraine complex. And that cascade then starts the pain.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. So for somebody that has migraine brain, like we talked about this last time, that there is a certain percentage of people that are wired a little bit differently that do have this quote unquote migraine brain. Do they ever reach a state where they're always constantly having migraines? It sounds like it kind of comes and goes at a pretty random interval. Some people say like it's maybe once a quarter, but every, once a year, it's an entire month, like five times a week or something. It kind of come and go. Is that normal?
It's completely normal. And it actually can increase over the lifetime of the person. And it depends on the activity of the brain. And this is a touchy topic because many people are told, many women, most of, well, 12 to 15% of the population have migraines. And so when we're talking about people having migraines, 12 to 15% of the the population just in the United States alone is like over 40 million people, right? If you're talking about 12 to 15%. And so that 12 to 15% is such a big number. And so first of all, you're wondering, what actually does this mean in terms of genetics? How come so many people have it? And if they have it, first of all, we know why, what happens, but why do they have it and how come you don't have it? Because otherwise we are completely the same kind of people, right? So we all have the same everything. So we are genetically different, but then the question is why we are different. And so the biggest problem is that over the past 100 years or so, when migraine has become very, very common, it's always existed, but it became more common. Many doctors tell elderly females or females who are getting up to the premenopausal or menopausal stage, they tell them, oh, it's going to disappear when you end up getting menopause. And that actually is bad. And so let me tell you how that works. As long as your migraines are increasing, that means that your brain is extremely active and you have all the connections and you have everything going and it's, you know, significant. When migraine stops, that means something changed in your brain, something degenerated. And so in order to understand what that is, you have to understand that the migraine brain is different in that the sensory neurons associated with your eyes, ears, nose, the taste, touch, these are the ones that are enhanced. And I have an evolutionary explanation for this, which is that basically all humans were like this at the beginning. Because if you go to nature and you look at any wild animal, be it mammal or any other kind, they're always on alert. Every single animal has to be on alert. And they have to discover if there is a danger, an animal, a predator that's about to eat them. But it's better for them to discover it long before the predator comes. I mean, it's famous that there are animals that alert other animals, for example, because they see better, but there's some animal type is, for example, hearing better or whatever. They have very enhanced sensory organs. So humans too used to have such sensory organs because we used to live among these animals in the open, right? In the prairies. And then adaptation happened as humans moved into homes and moved out of areas where this danger appeared. But not everybody adapts at the same rate. And so I'm suspecting that there's a population of people who haven't adapted so well or at all to the modern lifestyle. And by this modern lifestyle, I include carbohydrates, carbs, light, anything that's artificial and anything that is basically protecting us from the need for this particular alertness. And so this alertness then has to express in a different way. And there's a chemical trick behind it all, because if you took all the migraineurs of the world and you put them on an uninhibited island and provided them exactly the same kind of food that they would have eaten, say 300,000 years ago, they would not have a single migraine. This is why the carnivore diet works amazingly. Of course, there are some modifications today because our life is different. We still have the light, we still have the cars, we still have the traffic and all the stimulation, which we shouldn't be having. And so it makes it very difficult, even with the carnivore diet, to control the migraine. But the reason is that we are living in an environment that is not natural to us, and we just simply haven't adapted the same way as other people have. And so when we're talking about migraine coming on sometimes just once a quarter, and then later maybe in your life once a day, and then later every day, yes, it's because you haven't changed your lifestyle. And so all the negative things that caused the migraine to the first place, the first time you got it, you still continue doing. And so it gets worse and worse and worse because your threshold after, it's just like a stress. A little bit of stress is good, right? A lot of stress is not good. And if that stress continues forever in your life, that is going to make it worse and worse and worse. And so then you're going to reach a point where your body says, that's it. I can't handle this anymore. And like, I'm unable to replenish the nutrients. I'm unable to do anything. I'm in big trouble. Start the emergency. And from now on, until it's fixed, I'm just going to hurt. That's just the way it is.
Wow. Wow, that is absolutely mind-blowing. And so if we could take a magic wand and erase all of the stuff that we have as part of our modern lifestyles, the food, the environments, the lights, all of that stuff, we might be, and placed into a more natural environment that we would have evolved in, we might be sad for a week that we couldn't go on Instagram, but we would get over that very quickly, and we and people that have migraines would no longer experience symptoms.
Exactly. And this is what we actually see in the Facebook migraine group. When we change our environment, and we should talk about what that is, then the migraines pretty much disappear. I personally can still obviously get migraines. I get prodromes. So it's another thing we talked about, the pain, is that it isn't just a pain and it isn't just a migraine. Migraine comes with prodromes. So you have visible signs, or at least signs that you can feel prior to a migraine. And you can act on them. So these prodromes will always be there, even on an uninhibited island, because the migraine brain is anatomically different from a brain of a person who doesn't have migraines. And that's because this adaptation isn't just like, okay, saying, okay, so from tomorrow, I'm going to be fine with noise and carbohydrates and light, but it is an actual physiological change in the brain, an anatomical change. So in a migraine brain, because we are more responsive to the environment and we are more on higher alert, our neurons associated with the sensory organs are different from yours or from somebody who doesn't have migraines, because the number of connections between these nerve cells that transmit messages is a lot more in the migraine brain than in the other brain. And there are a lot of papers on this. And so we have more connections. So for example, if a migraineur and a non-migraineur and a migraineur side by side are presented with the same exact stimulus, say light, same strength, the migraineur is going to think of it as a brighter light, just because there's going to be more neuronal communication and it's a more stimulation that is not inhibited, but it's just allowed to continue as a higher level of stimulus. So the migraine brain will assume it's a stronger light. So it isn't like, for example, migraineurs are sensitive to bright light. It's not bright light. It's just the same light as any other light, but they just comprehend it brighter. So the brain translates it as brighter because it is more enhanced. So the sounds too, migraineurs can hear sounds that are very, very faint, particular sounds that are outside of the norm. Like you always hear some white noise. And I'm not talking about noises like the lawnmower or some other kind of a strong noise. But for example, it may be a very noisy environment where I live, and out of the blue, the foghorn, which is 20 miles from me, will go off. You may not even know that there's a foghorn there, but I will hear it. Wow. Because it's different from the general usual white noise. And so the migraine vision, for example, I have really bad eyes, I have wearing glasses, but you can't pass by me in my periphery without me noticing that something passed.
Wow.
And so we have different abilities as a result. And so our sensitivity is so strong that in the brain, in order to generate electricity, we have to use salt, sodium. That's the function of the sodium in the brain. And so we need more. It's basically that simple, because a migraine brain just simply uses more. We have more neuronal connections. We have more stimulus coming in. We just simply have a different requirement for our food. Now, back in the ancient time, we didn't have all this stimulus. And so at that time, when we were more sensitive to or heard more, for example, that a lion is in the bush, more other people were like this as well. And so we didn't get a migraine at that time, because also when we caught an animal, for example, we would eat the blood, and the blood is extremely salty. I just calculated the other day of how much sodium is in just one cup of blood. It is over, it's like 2,600 milligrams sodium. Wow. That's more than the daily allowance as per the FDA. And that's in one cup of salt, of blood. Wow. They take one cup of blood from you. So our blood is extremely salty. And so if you kill an animal and you take its blood, fantastic. You just had your daily sodium right there.
Wow, that's crazy. And to contrast that with the amount of sugar we have in the blood, which is absolutely minuscule in comparison. So crazy to think about.
Right. It's minuscule, and also what sugar does, which is something that nearly nobody remembers of, yet it's in every textbook and it's every medical manual in the very front, is that when sugar can only, or glucose, I should say, can only enter into the cell by taking something out of the cell. I mean, a cell is not empty, it's full. So if think of a glass of water completely full to the top, then you want to put in as much as a molecule of glucose, something has to come out, right? It sort of kind of sprays out. And so when glucose enters the cells, two things come out. One is water, and that's because a glucose molecule has 6 water molecules in it. So automatically a glucose molecule going in is going to displace 6 water molecules, because it's an exchange. It's just an equal exchange of the water molecules. And in addition to that, in order for the glucose to go into the cell, it uses the energy. It's not just a free diffusion kind of a transport rate, can go wherever it wants to. Glucose can't enter the cell without some sort of active transport. And so there are 2 kinds of transport, insulin or sodium. And 95% of the glucose in our body actually is active transport via sodium. And so when the way that works is that as sodium leaves the cell, it leaves through a voltage-gated channel, it creates enough energy for the glucose to go in. It's sort of kind of an exchange. And of course, they use protein pores to come and go. But so every time you eat carbohydrates, when the glucose enters from the blood into a cell, it's going to take out both water and sodium. And so if you're a migraineur and if you eat carbohydrates and you're removing sodium and water, first of all, the water is going to go into edema, which is not within the cell and not outside of the cell. It's sort of kind of nowhere. And the sodium is going to be kicked out. So you're unable to generate electricity.
Wow. So it just makes everything worse.
Totally. Right.
Yeah. Wow. That is so interesting. I do want to go back. You were talking a little bit about physical senses in a migrainer, the heightened, I guess, sensitivity for physical senses. But I think we talked about last time that it can also extend into like emotional senses, right? Like a Hallmark commercial might make you cry, or you'll be able to pick on more subtle nuances in conversation. Is that also true?
I'm guilty. I can cry on any commercial. So absolutely. So it isn't that it makes you more sensitive per se, but is that these feelings release certain hormones and they activate certain, it could be stress could be positive and negative, right? So if somebody told you tomorrow that you have $1 million, that would be a positive stress. It would still relieve stress hormones. It doesn't really matter why it's released, it's releasing it. And so if I start crying, I'm going to be releasing stress hormones. These are just connected. And every time I change my internal environment, stress hormones release glucose. So what am I doing? I'm just not flooding my system with glucose and my cells getting more glucose, and I just kicked sodium out of my cells. And so people, for example, just recently had several migraine members in the group who lost some family member. The biggest of the stress that they have, of course, is the loss of a family member. And our recommendation is that take salt without water, because this is just a huge amount of glucose suddenly entering your cells. And it's a huge amount of stimulation also for the neurons that need to generate electricity, because suddenly they need to generate more serotonin, more dopamine. I mean, they try to make you feel you better, right? So it's going to be requiring a lot more neurotransmitters as well. So you will have more brain firing just for that. And so it's usually tames the condition. And also, I just recently read an article that back to my original research that you mentioned, which was neuroeconomics. My primary research was on oxytocin. And the oxytocin is a hormone that releases and makes people, it's a bonding hormone. It's also called the love hormone. And the article that I bumped into by total coincidence, it just said, is that this was on rats or mice, one of the two, some rodent. When they fed them salt, they released more oxytocin and they became friendlier. Wow. And it activates a whole lot of other feel-good pathways. And so sodium has a huge role in how we feel as well. So it's not just to generate electricity, but it actually is. And this is probably why there are some people who absolutely crave salt and must have salt. That's probably telling them that something in their brain needs extra salt.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. I love your work on oxytocin. I think you've done some excellent studies on that in the past, and we've talked about that before. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love that. I do want to bring up something else we talked about a little bit last time as well, before we talk a little bit more about lifestyle things that we can start addressing. Pretty much every time I point this out to somebody who has a migraine, they tell me that they are the exception. They'll say something like, nope, maybe other people that's true for, but that is absolutely not true for me. I'm wondering if you get the same feedback when I tell people that 100% of the time when you have a migraine, there is something that will, there's a sign that happens somewhere about a day before you actually have that. Is that absolutely true? And do you get the same pushback where people say like, no, I don't. Other people might, but I don't.
Right. I get the exact same feedback. And then what happens is somebody will post a particular prodrome that is something new to them. This, again, it happened today. Somebody posted a prodrome, or actually last night, she said, why does this always happen? I feel so good. I'm so full of energy. And I start cleaning the cabinet in the middle. And when everything's finally packed out for me to clean and pack away, then bang, I come in with a migraine. Well, that was a prodrome that she's above with energy, more energy and full of wanting to do stuff. And some even refer to it as like a high. They feel sort of euphoric. And once she posted this, then you should see the number of comments after that. Oh, wow, that's me. I feel euphoric. Oh, I'm doing this all the time. I didn't know this was a prodrome. And so we have a lot of prodromes that are just simply unknown. And also most people, if they feel good, like this woman did, who decided that, oh, I'm so full of energy, let me just unpack the kitchen and let me clean it tip to toe, they feel good. Why would they think that this is a prodrome of something bad to come, right? I mean, they feel really good. We normally assume that a prodrome has to be negative, that it has to be something that feels bad, like fatigue or whatever. It isn't necessarily so. It can also be that you're just full of something. And so she asked me, well, what could this be? Why would I feel so good and suddenly, bang, come down with a migraine? And this, of course, this is estimations, a hypothesis. It's not something that I can test. But I believe that this is something to do with a fight or flight. So when you have a fight or flight kicking in for whatever reason, it could have been carb, could have been some anxiety, it could have been a commercial that you started crying or whatever it is, it starts a fight or flight. And a fight or flight basically releases a stress hormone or more than one. And then it starts, for example, increases your heart rate, it increases your blood flow, blood pressure, blood flow, the oxygenation rate, and you suddenly have a lot of energy because what it's supposed to do is to make you either fight or flight. That's what it's supposed to do. So if you feel so good, if you go for a little run, everything, all these hormones are going to relax and gonna feel good. So when you're so full of energy, you're going to do something. That's the goal. But when you're doing something, and this is a part of a fight or flight, it is the sign that it's a migraine, because within the trimigraine complex, the first symptom of a migraine is the fight or flight. That is how it starts, because the brain says, I don't need enough salt. I need to have more something to get the electricity going. The brain doesn't know it's salt. It just knows it's not working. It needs to have more electricity going. And so it starts a fight or flight, that panic alert, push the panic block. Alert, that's the fight or flight. And it can manifest in a host of different ways. It can manifest with throwing up first, because that's also part of fight or flight, that everything undigested in the food is going to come up. It can manifest in an anxiety. It can manifest in feeling dizzy, because again, as part of the fight or flight, is things within your digestive organs have to come up, and being dizzy will make you eventually throw up. Vertigo, a host of different symptoms that can appear. And also yawning is part of the fight or flight. And so yawning would, in my, again, hypothesis, mean, you know how when you're watching films or nature films and you're looking at monkeys and they're threatening each other, and one of the things that they do is they show the incisors really big.
Yeah.
And so the yawning could very well be part of this particular function of showing the incisor, because it always appears like the yawning, right? And so that could very well be part of that as well. So it's kind of hard to fully understand it, of course, and we don't have a textbook on this, but and most of this is my hypothesis, but it appears to work out this way. So it appears that by now we have about 14,000 migraineurs total in two groups. And it seems that this is a pattern for all of us without exception. And so if it's that much of a pattern with 14,000 people, there has to be something in that.
Right. Yeah, no, clearly this isn't a subject you just learned about yesterday.
Right.
Just
right,
having some exactly. ideas about that. You can go so deep into some of these concepts. I really love that. So yeah, I'm sure you're more right than you are wrong about that. That sounds absolutely
it's important to say that. So then people who tell you that, well, it doesn't happen to me. It's just that they haven't discovered these because they feel so good or because it's such a minor. Like my biggest prodrome, and I mentioned this in our previous podcast, is that one eye gets smaller than the other. Well, it's not something I look at. You know, I can look into my own face and look to see what's happening, or there's a mirror on my wall here, and I can look at it all the time, but I never do. It's not something you normally do. And yet that is I find that in our migraine group, at least 99% of the migraineurs have that one eye becomes smaller before a migraine. And none of us noticed it before. Right. So it's something you have to kind of understand and look for.
Wow. Crazy. Okay. So for somebody that suffers with migraines, we've mentioned some of the things that they can do with lifestyle. Where should somebody start? Like, what are the most important lifestyle things that you've seen that when you put somebody in your groups through to at least get started to deal with this, what are some of the most important things that you want people to know and to start to address?
Okay. So the simplest and the most important thing, of course, is to stop eating sugar. That's priority number one, because that is the biggest, by far, the biggest troublemaker. And then the second troublemaker is they need to increase their hydration. And so I find that most people who join the group simply don't drink water. And this is something that is very important to note, because a lot of people are told a variety of different things about how much water they need. So for example, there is one particular saying that, 8 cups of water a day is fine. But then that would mean that a 10-year-old kid, a 99-year-old little old lady, and a 30-year-old football player would all just need 8 cups of water a day. I don't see that to be possible. And so we all need different water. Then another frequently said thing is that, well, you can count all liquids that you eat or drink. So for example, having a cup of coffee or tea or eating a watermelon or juice, these all count toward water, but they don't. And this is something that is very difficult to understand. And let me see if I can pull something to it, but let me finish first the sentence, which is that, so if you don't drink enough water and or blood, we have approximately 5 liters of blood, give and take, depending on our height or gender or activity, et cetera, but 4 to 5 liters. So 4 liters is a gallon. So it's a lot of blood that we have in us. But if they take all your blood out and they put it on the scale and you take the actual proteins, which would be your red blood cells and the white blood cells, all those kind of things out, and you have water, is the rest, it's a lot of water. And so if you don't drink enough water, what is going to replace the water in your blood? And yet blood is the most important element in your body. That's the one that carries all the nutrients and also all the toxins. So if you don't drink enough, even if you eat the right amount of sodium, even if you don't eat any sugar or any of the bad stuff, you still are going to end up with a migraine because you simply don't have enough blood volume to fully engage your body and to fully provide the sodium everywhere where it should go in a fast and likely manner. And without being a hypertension also. And then also the toxins won't remove. So then you're going to have a buildup of all the carbon dioxide and all kind of other things that should be just circulating around all the time. And so the most important thing then is not just to quit sugar, but to also check how much water they drink and what they eat. And so let me talk a little bit about this water, which is a very important thing of why eating water versus drinking water, eating water in foods or drinking water in foods versus drinking just water are very different for our body. There's no water in your body. There's not a single drop of water in your body. What you have is oxygen and hydrogen molecules. So everything that we eat or drink breaks down into its actually atomic ionic structures. And so some of these molecules and atoms that are broken down to are polar. So for example, water, which is two hydrogen and one oxygen atoms, their formulation is such that both sides remain polar. This is a very unusual molecule. both sides are charged. So one side is slightly positively charged and the other side is slightly negatively charged. And so whatever you put the water into, it immediately forms a bond. And once that bond is formed, so say coffee, for example, you can't separate it. How would you get water out of a cup of coffee in your body? You have to boil the water or the coffee. You have to capture the steam, right? You have to cool it to make it into water again. We don't have a boiler inside us. We don't have a thing that captures the steam. We don't have any of those. We work with chemical bases. And can I chemically separate water from coffee? Sure. I need a nuclear facility. Wow. And we can do it. Our body can do it. Absolutely can do it. But it just takes too much of an effort. So if you really want to have water in your system, you need to drink water, which can then right away act as still is going to break up into hydrogen and oxygen. And they each will add into their very specific way. In some cases, it may remain together as a molecule. So, for example, if you're looking at, I've just been studying a lot about the cell, how do things cross into the cell? And I looked at the oxygen, the water, and everything. So when I'm looking at the water crossing into the cell, each cell is in a little mini ocean because we are basically sea creatures. And so a cell is surrounded by what's called an interstitial space. The cells themselves don't connect. So like you think that your cells are connected because you're looking at your skin, they aren't actually connected. So each cell has a little layer that's called the glycocalyx, which are like little fingers, like very hair-like structures. They connect, but the cells themselves don't connect. So in between two cells, for example, there will be that's called the interstitial space, which is not inside of the cell, but not in the blood either. It's sort of like a storage space. So when you're looking at a cell there, the cell has a respiratory process. Like we inhale and exhale, the cell inhales and exhales, but not oxygen. They inhale and exhale water.
Wow.
And it's the movement of the sodium and the potassium in the water. And so a cell has what's called aquaporins, which are like little pores everywhere on the cell. I mean, we're talking about thousands of pores where it can, the water can go through. But they go through one molecule at a time. So these cells are so tiny that each water molecule is going through one molecule at a time into the cell and then come out one molecule at a time when as the cell is breathing. So water remains in this particular interstitial space as water, but otherwise it's broken down into elements. Now, if you don't drink water, but you're having only a cup of coffee, how are you going to get this water in the interstitial space around the cells, right? So you have to have pure water. And the same with eating watermelon or any kind of fruits with a lot of water. There's not water, not free water available to us. So we have to really drink the water that we want to use as water. That's really the only solution.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. That's so interesting. We've already mentioned quite a bit already the importance of electrolytes and salt. Can you talk about how we know when we're getting enough salt or somebody who suffers with migraines, how they know how to balance that hydration with also intaking salt?
We would never know what the balance is. So it's a good trial and error. Among migraineurs, it's still a trial and error. I set up certain guidelines, but I found to be, first of all, safe for everyone, regardless who they are. And so far, every single doctor also agreed and supported, for example, the amount of salt they put in water, because it is less than if you go to a hospital or an emergency room and they put intravenous saline into you. That has 3 times more sodium in it than what we, for example, put into our water as standard for migraineurs.
Gotcha.
So there's plenty of room to increase if you have to. So for example, I have POTS. I had to double it. My doctor told me, oh, just double it. So I'm taking twice as much as what I used to take as a migraineur, and I'm still below what it would be if I had received an intravenous solution. And if you talk to nurses, we have plenty of nurses in the migraine group. They will tell you that people with heart disease and cancer and stroke and everything, they come and we just pile the salt on because they end up getting edema of it added. Because if you don't have enough sodium, then all this water, what's going to happen to all this water, which is part of the inflammatory process, right?
That's right.
And so sodium is essential also to reduce inflammation. And so it's very difficult sometimes to separate how much we need and when and why. But this is when some of these prodromes come in really handy, Because if I take salt, say I take I take salt capsules, and say I take two salt capsules, which is in my case is 720 milligram sodium. It's about a gram of salt. If I take two of these, but my environment changed such that I need more, then I will see my eyes still going to be smaller. And so my eyes are going to be equal size if I'm properly salted, is what I'm saying.
Wow.
And this is very similar to other migrant nurses. So they may need less or need more. Sometimes I find that, for example, this eye, which is normally smaller when I need salt, is bigger. That means I'm not needing salt. I have too much salt. I need potassium. So then I will eat some potassium food. We never supplement potassium because in our blood, there's very little potassium. We have 30 times more sodium in our blood. And so we don't want to drink potassium as a supplement because then it goes into our blood. And we don't want there too much. That's a hyperkalemia and it can cause serious heart problems. And so we don't actually know. What we do is we take some and then we look in the mirror or we see how we feel. If I have an aura, did my aura weaken? Did it disappear? But before we even take salt, oftentimes we really don't know what we need. Then we do what's called a salt test. So we put a little bit of salt under the tongue, which just without water absorbs. And if it helps, it's very good for aura migraine because it absorbs, then it's usually sodium, but maybe not always. But if it helps, it will help within a couple of minutes. And if the auras are weakening or going away, then you know, okay, I'm going to need more salt. And if it gets worse, I need to go and grab an avocado for potassium or grab a steak if I am carnivore. And so we don't know. But in our foods, because in our body, believe it or not, there's a website. You can actually find out how many sodium or salt and how many sodium and how many potassium molecules or atoms you have in your body. And the numbers actually differ because potassium is much bigger than sodium. So by weight, they're the same, but by count, we have much more sodium than potassium. But by weight, they're the same. So if I am eating food, I want to balance the sodium and potassium 1:1 because the absorption of both sodium and potassium from the food is going to be through the intestines directly into the cell. And so I want the cell to decide where the sodium and potassium is going. And if I drink, I don't want to add potassium. I just have sodium because it's just going to go straight to my blood. It has a different entry point from the gut.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. I've never considered that. That's so cool that you can, you know, use those signs and symptoms and prodromes, if I said that right, to be able to tell what direction you need to go with, you know, hydration and salt and all that stuff. That's so interesting.
Exactly. And it also helps for us to know, you know, did I get this prodrome because I had a bunch of sweets or do I have some stress or did I get it because the barometric pressure just changed? There are a ton of variables. And so you need to have a little bit of a background to see what actually caused the prodrome itself that sort of kind of knocked you out of balance. And then you can make up for it in testing and see.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So you've already talked about eliminating sugar. You've also mentioned the carnivore diet. And carnivore diet is a nice way to eliminate sugar. If you decide you're only going to eat meat, then you have no room for sugar in the diet, really. But with carnivore, there's also this idea that not only just that meat is really good for you and has everything that you need, but also that plant foods can be actively toxic and bad for you. And so what have you noticed in the migraine space? Is it just that meat is good for you? Is it that plant foods are bad for you? Or should most people be just okay if they're just not eating a lot of sugar?
That's a very good question. And I have to say that it depends on the person and depends on their sensitivities. So people who come into my group with a lot of autoimmune health conditions, they will immediately be placed on the carnivore diet because we know that we need to eliminate. So that's going to be the perfect elimination diet is a carnivore diet. And it isn't just all meat. So let me explain the carnivore diet. And also within the migrant group, our carnivore diet is a little bit different. So the carnivore diet is animal products. So it's not just meat. So for example, we drink milk, we eat cheese, we are very much supported that. We also poultry, eggs, we eat a ton of eggs. Which an egg is like a nose to tail entire animal. So it has all the nutrients in it. Fish, seafood, organs, bone marrow, whatever. So we basically eat everything that we want to eat that is animal product. And in saying carnivore, I'm saying all animal, but it isn't quite true because what I'm trying to do is eliminate all plants. And so there are some sort of plantish like foods that people consider plants that aren't really plants. So for example, mushroom is a fungi. And if you look at where it's placed, it's much closer to the animal kingdom than plants are. And so I always joke also with some people who are, well, I'm just vegan. I don't eat anything. But I said, well, are you eating mushrooms? I said, yeah, I love mushrooms. I said, well, you're not vegan. Because they don't realize that that's not actually a plant.
It's a really good and point.
It's a very important point. And mushroom, by some other doctors and professors and professionals, they suggest that mushrooms are full of anti-nutrients. Everything that's not animal have anti-nutrients. But the question is how much and what it can do. Mushroom has some anti-nutrients, but not that much. It doesn't have, for example, phytates, which would be the worst anti-nutrient. And so whatever anti-nutrients it has, it's actually very low on the scale. And another one that they also permit under the carnivore diet is kelp or seaweed. Because again, it's closer to the plant-like creature, but it is a protozoa, basically. Kelp, it's not, it's an algae. So it's not a plant. It's not an animal, but it's still not a plant. And it has some benefits. And the trick is that neither one of these really has fibers, right? So if it has no fiber, and if it's not a plant, then it's edible. Like I eat, for example, crickets. I absolutely love roasted crickets. It's not an animal. It's an insect. It actually has fiber in it, believe it or not, because they eat a lot of fiber. And you eat the whole animal as is. They don't separate the stomach and the intestines and the whatever else. It's the whole animal. It's roasted. I love it. It's a crunch. And so we eat all kinds of things that is basically not plant. So gotcha. I think I would define carnivore that way a little bit better. And so when you eat the carnivore, that's an absolutely perfect elimination diet, except for dairy. Some people may be sensitive to dairy, so then we also eliminate dairy to test. That's how we would start those who have a lot of autoimmune diseases. So it really isn't a choice by them or what they do. I mean, it's always ultimately a choice. If they decide that, no, they just can't stomach the carnivore for whatever reason, fine. It's just going to take a lot longer for them to recover because of all the autoimmune diseases that have to heal. I've been in my diet officially. The group is open for 8 years, but I've been doing it for longer than that. And in the 8 years, we went through a whole lot of iterations and changes. So I would say that low carb, keto, kind low carb for 7 years. Even today, I'm discovering things. Hey, I no longer have this. I used to have this problem. I no longer have it. So improvement is a very long process.
Yeah, that's amazing. We notice the same thing. Some people will go to carnivore because they want to lose weight or they want to deal with skin issues or digestive issues. And then they realize not only did they help the problem that they came to carnivore to solve, but they just fixed 10 other things that they didn't know that carnivore could even address anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and you won't know that until you actually try it. You won't know what it's going to cure.
That's right. And so many stories are similar to mine. Like I just wanted to try it for 30 days. I knew I wasn't going to kill myself in 30 days. And you get to day 31, you're like, well, I'm just going to keep going because this is great. I feel amazing. I do want to ask you a little bit about protein. I'm really glad that the low carbohydrate world tends to be shifting back its opinion on protein because for a while there, especially with like pushing the ketogenic diet, people were eating tons of fat and saying you needed to be afraid of protein. That seems to be going away now, which I'm so glad it is. What is your opinion on the intake of protein? Should we fear protein or should we eat protein as much as possible or somewhere in between?
I am very much in support of a high protein. So eat as much protein as possible. And I even allow for my migraineurs to add to their regular high protein meals, which is meat or eggs and these kind of things. I also permit now protein powders, not as a smoothie. So we don't have a smoothie, but we may add it to our meat. So for example, I will make a fried fish that is to die for, which has absolutely... I dip it into whey protein powder, then the eggs and the milk, and then after that with pork rind dust.
Wow.
And then fry it in butter. It's amazing. It's better than any other fried food I've ever had.
It sounds better than crickets.
Crickets taste really good. You don't know, have you tried crickets yet?
Not yet. They don't have it available at the local restaurant just yet.
Well, no, not a restaurant, but you can order on Amazon roasted. They're really tasty. But anyway, so back to the protein. So I'm in very high support of protein because if you look at the three available, we have four macronutrients, basically. Well, we have carbohydrates, protein, fats, and alcohol. Alcohol is a macronutrient and it burns like on its own 7 kcal. But I mean, we don't want to have alcohol, so I removed that. So we have the 3 main macronutrients that we can eat. And of the 3, which is then carbohydrates, fat, and protein, carbohydrates and fat are both pretty much only energy, just fuel. There could be some structural out of fat. We have some fat elements within our membranes for each cell. We also have a little bit of glycogen in each cell. So we have a little bit of both as structural elements within the cells. And of course, our brain is primarily made out of fat and cholesterol, which is actually a wax. So it's not even a fat. But so we have a structural need for fat as well. But the primary structural element in our body is protein. So if I'm looking at the cell, other than the gel-like substance, which is the water and electrolytes mixed in, the rest of the cell is pretty much just protein. There will be a little bit of fat in there, but maybe like 2%. But it's a very large percent of the cell is going to be protein. And so it's like 35% or something that I was looking at it last time. So if you're looking at the size of the protein, and you know, people say, well, let's do protein synthesis. And when you're talking about protein synthesis, everybody thinks about growth of muscles. But that's not protein synthesis. That's one kind of protein synthesis, because when you have, say, skin cells replace every 3 to 4 months, your blood cells replace every 10 days or so, your stomach cells replace every 2 to 4 days, your intestinal cells replace every 4 days. I mean, these cells need to be replaced. And I just said 35% of these cells is made out of protein. Yeah. So how do they get there? So if you don't have protein synthesis, and that's because of what protein synthesis does, very few people understand. So when you eat protein from, say, beef, okay, there are 20 amino acids within a class of protein that we can eat. And so we use those amino acids, but if you take my body apart, it's not going to have just glutamate here, glutamic acid here, leucine there, and whatever, valine somewhere else. In our body, every single cell other than the sperm cells, which would be, the cells to for sperm and egg, in every other cell, we basically have the DNA, which is identical all through our body. And what does the DNA representing code for? Just how to make human proteins. And what are the human proteins? They're chains of connected amino acids. So there's going to be a huge difference between, say, leucine, valine, and glycine connection versus if I reorder it, so glycine and leucine and valine. So there, I can make 3 to the power of 3 combinations with this, right? So 9 different combinations. And so we have 20 different amino acids, 21 actually, but 20 used actual amino acids. Then these will be in different kind of connections, creating the kind of proteins that our body is made of. And our bones, everybody thinks, I need to have calcium for bones. No, you don't. You actually need protein for bones because your bone is over 40% protein. Yeah. And so when we talk about protein synthesis, these are the things that we're talking about. We aren't just talking about athletes building muscles, because everybody thinks, well, I don't need protein powder because I'm not working out. Is it? Duh. That's not why you're taking it. You're eating too little protein and your body needs to be able to start protein synthesis, and you can't start it unless you have a certain amount of leucine, which is the branching amino acid, which is the signaling molecule to start protein synthesis. It's the most difficult process in the body. And so eating a lot of protein, even if you eat more protein, then the argument says, well, if I eat too much protein, it's going to convert to glucose. So yes, it's going to convert to glucose, but it's not the same glucose as if you eat an apple. It's a completely different kind of a glucose. Yeah. It's a slow, it's driven by the need kind of a glucose conversion, rather than you just eat an apple and whether you wanted it or not, you're overloaded with glucose in your blood. It's not going to happen from protein. So those with complete metabolic health can eat a ton of protein and they can wear a CGM monitor and they're going to see a near straight line with their protein, no matter how much they eat. And also no matter how much they fast. I mean, I have been to a 5-day fast and I measure my blood glucose and blood ketones several times when I'm fasting. It's usually almost every hour just to be sure that I don't go outside or above a certain range. And boy, my blood glucose is like a straight line. It's between 82 and 95 nonstop, all through 5 days. It just simply doesn't drop. And the same when I'm eating just carnivore. Of course, I don't eat carnivore. I chose to eat more hypercarnivore, and summertimes is more keto. But down to when I ate carnivore for 6 months. And so it was fantastic. It's just, I personally didn't care for some of the things that much, and I didn't want to hate meat. So I added some carbs back minimally. So it's individual. But what I discovered is everybody says, well, you're going to come out of ketosis. And I said, okay, as an argument, you will come out of ketosis for a little time when you eat a lot of protein, because it is going to have to be synthesized. You have to, by definition, come out of ketosis when you're doing protein synthesis. And people say, well, why do I have to do that? Well, ketosis is when you're using your fat to burn as fuel. So it's a catabolic function. It takes away from your body. It reduces what you already have. And protein synthesis is an anabolic function. It adds to what you're trying to do. The two cannot exist at the same time. So you're either catabolic or anabolic. So if insulin is active, and insulin has to be initiated, it has to be active for protein synthesis. Or if you bring down and just eat the amino acids without any carbohydrates, without any fat, just on its own, protein synthesis won't start. So it needs to have everything in it. And there's enough glycogen in meat. Every cell has a little bit of glycogen. There's enough fat in meat. And then the protein synthesis will start. And so when you're looking at all this, it's building. It's going to use insulin. Without insulin, protein synthesis can't start, because protein synthesis creates a protein, but it has to be taken to its place. It has to be built into something. And so insulin is used for that. So even though you're coming out of ketosis, you're coming out with good health. I mean, that's the goal. The goal is not ketosis. Ketosis is basically a mode. It's like you're driving a Honda versus whatever car. It's a car you drive, but that's not the goal. The goal is to get to places, right? And so where you want to get to is to become healthy, have lots of healthy cells, replace your cells that are non-functional or damaged, and create new cells. Create, if you have damage to your kidneys or liver or heart, can you replace those cells? Can you fix those cells? Those require a protein synthesis.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. I'm so glad you brought that up. I do have one more question for you. And this is about people who are maybe listening to this and think that, you know, there's a few components here and obviously things that people need to be thinking about, but it is fairly simple to have this idea that you may not ever have migraine symptoms for the rest of your life if you follow a few certain things. For somebody who says, I don't want to do that, or maybe I'm skeptical of that, I'm just going to go to my doctor and go to the medical system to see what they can provide me. What would you want them to know?
They can always get medications. The question is, number one, are they going to work? Because from my experience and from 14,000 members by now in the Facebook group, and many, several thousands who are no longer in the group because they're completely cured, and they're not on medications, but they will tell you that none of the medications worked. And so they may work for a little time, and then after a while, the body compensates, because there's still a problem. They don't actually solve the problem. So let's take, for example, one of the medications that is the most recent and most people want to go for it, which is a CGRP inhibitor. CGRP is a calcitonin gene. It's a gene that is, in the migraine world of research, considered to be the cause of migraine. Of course, it's not, because this gene is all over the body. It's on the heart. It's digestive organs. It's in the brain. It's everywhere. And so what people are beginning to discover is that, well, for a time, for some people, not all, I would say about 60% of the people get immediate benefit from it, and they won't have any migraine pain. That is true, because the brain is full of this particular gene, these receptors, and these receptors are basically pain sensors in the brain. They're actually outside of the brain, in the between the brain and the skull, where there's a fine layer, the meninges. So they're in the meninges. And so what they do is they inhibit them, so they can't take up the pain signal. But what does that mean? It's like you have a broken arm from playing tennis, but you now can't feel it, and you continue to play tennis. So you're actually doing more damage with the particular organ. And so in a case of brain, some of these medications, of course, cause systemic problems. So from what I now understand, and I'm a member in many of the migraine groups on Facebook that are taking CGRP inhibitors, the complaints go from falling, only hair falls out, because believe it or not, there is CGRP receptor on the blood vessels right by the hair. So it kills the blood vessels right there and your hair falls out. Nearly everybody is now taking hypertensive, like a beta blocker, because they all end up hypertensive. They all have to go on steroid for 2 weeks after they take the medication, because it causes a whole body inflammatory process. For some people, it wipes out their pancreas, their kidney. I mean, you're talking major problems, but yes, they may be pain-free. But then the question is being pain-free really truly migraine-free? It's not, because I said earlier at the beginning that pain is not even necessary for migraine, right? And so to remove the pain, which is a symptom, but to remain sick at the same time isn't necessarily sufficient. And like there's another drug, which is topiramate, that's a generic form, which is basically used for seizures, but a lot of migraineurs get it. And what it does, it prevents sodium and calcium from entering the cells. Well, what does that mean? The cells can communicate. A cell in the brain that can't communicate gets to be trimmed, meaning their connections are trimmed. It's brain degenerative. So this is why a lot of people who take that, they end up calling it Dopamix, because they feel doped because they can't function. So it's just, so you just need to know that the migraine doesn't disappear. What disappears is just the pain, maybe, and only for a short time, because then the body will adjust, because say, hey, the problem is not resolved. So the body will override the pain reducer and starts hurting in a different way. Wow. The same thing.
Yeah, that is absolutely so fascinating. This has been an amazing conversation. I could have gone for hours with you before and more hours today. There's just so much you've done in your research that has made this accessible for people and really practical, that I absolutely love. Where can people go to be able to find you, connect with you and your work, and get some relief from suffering from migraines?
Yeah, so they can find me, of course, on Facebook in my migraine group. I have two. One of them is Center Migraine Protocol. Actually, just search for Center Migraine Protocol on Facebook, because I don't even remember the group name. They can find me on Twitter at Migraine Book. That's my handle. They can also find me at stentomigraineprotocol.com. And I have a nonprofit, which is stentomigraineprotocol.org. So they can send messages in any of these.
That's awesome. We will link to all of that in the show notes. Dr. Angela Stanton, thank you so very much for, again, all of your research, everything that you've discovered about this, and all the hope that you provide for people that are suffering with this. We really appreciate you, and we appreciate your work, and we appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to be on our show today. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Absolutely. And this has been another episode of Balanced Body Radio. As always, thank you so very much for listening to Boundless Body Radio. It's really inspiring and amazing to see some of the reviews that we have been getting, and also to receive so many messages and emails about how these episodes have improved our listeners' lives. And so thank you so very much. We are so happy to bring these episodes to you and provide them for free. And we really hope that they help you in your life. We have just passed two major milestones, which are absolutely mind-blowing to me. And basically, we did both of these in pretty much the exact same day. We have just passed 100,000 downloads worldwide of Boundless Body Radio, and we have just launched our 250th episode, which is absolutely amazing. Like I said, I never imagined we could reach that many people. We always want to keep you updated on things that we're doing on our website. So if you go to myboundlessbody.com, you can always see what we're up to. This month, we have a link that you can go and schedule a functional movement screen, which we do virtually over Zoom. A functional movement screen is a series of 7 different movements and 3 different clearing tests, which is designed to find weak links in the body, such as muscle imbalances and joint stability issues. It's a really great tool for discovering inefficient movement. And even if you're not experiencing pain in certain areas of your body, it's something that can prevent injury later on. Some muscles need to be stretched, some need to be strengthened, and we can help you create a plan around that so that you can stay healthy and continue to move well for the rest of your life. So again, you can go and schedule that at myboundlessbody.com. You will also see the other services that we offer. You can always schedule a complimentary 30-minute consultation with us to really chat about anything that you like. And remember, if you are enjoying Boundless Body Radio, please take a minute, give us a rating or review on Apple. It really helps get this passion project out to other people. And thank you again for tuning into Boundless Body Radio.